Cabinet jitters are mentioned in the lead headline of the Irish Independent. The paper says that the government is bracing for a delay in removing the remaining COVID-19 restrictions after a sudden change in the behaviour of the virus caused alarm among public health officials. As 2,066 new cases were reported yesterday, senior figures from the National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, told government officials of concerns over the rise in the number of tests carried out, the positivity rate and hospitalisations, the paper says. "We are not out of the woods," says the Irish Daily Mail, summing up the cautious words of the Taoiseach on the subject yesterday. The Irish Times leads with the new proposals from the European Commission designed to ease the implementation of Northern Ireland's post-Brexit arrangements. The paper reports that the offer to drop most checks on goods from Britain destined for Northern Ireland supermarket shelves and cut half of the customs formalities was based on discussions with local civic and business figures. Naomi O'Leary writes that Maroš Šefčovič, the EU's Brexit point man, in making his proposals, had to overcome the reservations of member states and resistance within the Commission. A diplomat is quoted as saying, "The Commission is pushing at the very edge of what is accepted by member states." The Irish Examiner leads with the statement by the Garda Commissioner Drew Harris that in light of the Sarah Everard murder case in London, he is setting up a review of investigations where Gardaí are accused of domestic or sexual violence to make sure they are investigated properly. The Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star lead with reports on a man they both describe as a Kinahan hitman who flew into Ireland in 2017 and was caught on CCTV strolling through Dublin and then arrested. As the papers report, an image from the CCTV footage features in an RTE primetime show tonight. The Irish Sun leads with a report on the inquest on a young woman who died of a blood clot hours after being discharged from University Hospital Limerick in 2019, in which the coroner gave a verdict of medical misadventure. The front page picture in the Examiner is of students outside the Dublin City Council offices on Wood Quay in the city centre yesterday, protesting about comments made by the council's chief executive, Owen Keegan, about student accommodation. But as is reported inside the Examiner and in other papers, Mr Keegan has already apologised for having said that he was surprised that UCD Students' Union had not entered the housing market itself after it had complained that private interests were ripping off students for excess profits. Meanwhile, farmers are scathing about the budget. "It exposes this government's lack of commitment to farmers and rural Ireland," writes Justin McCarthy in an editorial in the Irish Farmers Journal.
"There are increasing concerns over the rise in the number of people getting infected with and in hospital with COVID-19 ahead of a planned lifting of restrictions next week. Over 400 people are in hospital with the virus, 69 in ICU, and over 2,000 cases were reported again yesterday, despite three quarters of the population being fully vaccinated. The Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have been telling meetings of their parliamentary parties that the numbers are worrying, going in the wrong direction, and that decisions will be made over the coming days. Micheál Martin says he can't guarantee that the final phase of reopening will go ahead as planned next Friday."
Presentation from the Deputy Chief Medical Officer Ronan Glynn was a serious one. The trajectory of disease has taken a wrong turn. There's been what has been described as a sudden increase in the last week of case numbers. I think we're looking at over 2,000 case numbers today. And they want to see more data. They want to analyse this a bit more. And so we're going to reflect on it. And we will engage with the health authorities, public health authorities, and the HSE, obviously, over the coming days in the lead up to next week. And we'll make a final decision closer to that date. But suffice to say that it's very, very important that the public at large realise that COVID has not gone away. The Delta variant is a dangerous one. Numbers are higher in hospital than we would like them to be. They're over 400 now. They're having an impact on the hospital system. So those out there who haven't got the vaccine, I would urge people to get the vaccine because it does protect you against serious illness and hospitalisation and death. People should go back to the basics in terms of washing hands and observing the protocols that have been there from the outset of the pandemic. And I think this is an alert to all of us to knuckle down, refocus on this virus, because it hasn't gone away.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Christina Finn is political correspondent for thejournal.ie. Christina, good morning.
Good morning.
Remind us what's planned to happen from next Friday.
So on October 22nd, the final restrictions basically are due to be lifted. So while the majority of restrictions have already been lifted, what we're looking at is the need for social distancing, the wearing of face masks in some settings. But I suppose the main ones are the limit on numbers around concerts and sporting events that we'd all love to get back to. Obviously the reopening of nightclubs, which have been closed throughout the pandemic. But the main one, obviously, is the COVID pass, which differentiates between vaccinated and unvaccinated people for access into places like pubs and restaurants. So yesterday, I suppose, the mood music around government buildings, it wasn't great following that briefing from health experts who were warning around complacency and concern about those high figures that we're seeing. But I must caveat that with saying that there hasn't been no decision made, and there's no suggestion as of yet about further restrictions being imposed. This is really just sounding the alarm about uncertainty around that date next week.
Tell us more about the doubts that have arisen now and what's being said.
Yeah, so I understand from speaking to sources around government yesterday that they are concerned about the numbers that they're seeing, because it is going off what they sort of had expected to see. But they really want to see a lot more detail around the data. So I understand they have asked the health experts to probe and do a bit more of a deep dive into those numbers that we're seeing, particularly the high case numbers, but also the makeup of the hospitalizations that we're seeing, as you said, over 400 at the moment in hospital and 69 that are in ICU. So yesterday, Ronan Glynn was warning around, asking the 300,000 people who are unvaccinated to consider that, and also the 70,000 people who have yet to receive their first dose. But following those remarks, I understand that ministers have been asking to look at the breakdowns, particularly for the number of people that are fully vaccinated, that have tested positive for the virus, that feature in the daily numbers that we're obviously so used to seeing now pop up on our phones and all the rest. But also the people that are fully vaccinated, that are in hospital, that are perhaps presenting with COVID-19, as well as the breakdown of the hospital figures, of that 400 figure of patients that are presenting to hospital for the virus alone, against the people that are in hospital that might have contracted it while in there. These figures have been asked for before from Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, when he was concerned that at a time earlier this year, a third of the patients with COVID-19 in hospital had contracted the virus while they were being cared for in there. But obviously health experts are kind of saying that, look, it doesn't matter why they're in there. It does have an impact in terms of their day-to-day operating, how they separate those patients and the impact that it has on the health service. So I think they want a lot more detail before they make any final decision about pushing out that date.
And we'll be hearing from the HSC later. When will a decision be made, Christina? And what are the choices facing the government now?
I understand that Leo Varadkar told his parliamentary party meeting that they'll be in touch with health experts over the weekend, and that they'll be discussing this matter at Tuesday's cabinet meeting. Obviously, businesses that are relying on the 22nd of October date, they'll want as much a lead-in time as possible if they're going to reopen. And obviously, if things are going to be put on halt, there'll be serious concerns from those businesses who have been looking forward, I suppose, to getting back to normality. A very tough decision, I think, for the cabinet. There's definitely jitters from ministers about the further reopening. But from the people I was speaking to as well, they're very, very aware that the public has little or no appetite for the delay of the easing of the restrictions. I think a lot of people have been looking at the 22nd of October date, looking forward to getting back to somewhat of the most normal we've been in over 2 years. So I think they'll be pretty hesitant and want to see a lot more detail as to the cause and effect of these case numbers, given that we have such a high vaccination rate here in Ireland. But when we look to other countries in Europe, our infection rate is very much higher than the rest. So there's a bit of head scratching going on as to why we're seeing what we are seeing.
Christina, thank you. That's Christina Finn, political correspondent for the journal.ie.
Now, the EU says it's turned its rules upside down and inside out to come up with a solution on the Northern Ireland Protocol. And the plan to drop most checks on goods from the UK to Northern Ireland has been broadly welcomed by industry there. But the political reaction has been divided. We'll hear from the SDLP MP, Claire Hannah, in a moment. But here's DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson, who described the proposals as the EU's starting point on the 6-1 News last night.
These proposals fall well short of what we need, but we're going into the next stage of the process. We want to find a solution. We agree with Lord Frost what he said yesterday. What we need is to replace the current arrangements with new arrangements that respect Northern Ireland's place within the UK internal market, remove the Irish Sea border on the movement of goods between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and put in place practical arrangements for the movement of goods into the European Union.
DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson on the 6-1 News last night. With us now, the SDLP MP, Claire Hannah. Claire Hannah, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You heard Geoffrey Donaldson there, and we also heard yesterday evening the UUP leader, Doug Beattie, warning that opposition to the ECJ in relation to that, a brick will turn into a petrol bomb and a petrol bomb could turn into a coffin. What do you make of this unionist insistence on the European Court of Justice being a sticking point and their reaction to the EU proposals?
I just don't think it matches the reality of what people really are feeling on the ground on this. And I think there has been a degree of the response being created over the last 7 or 8 months and people being told that this is a terrible deal rather than actually feeling it. The fact is the Brexit years and the protocol years have been grim for Northern Ireland. But I believe the vast majority of the people have moved on in ways from the issue. Businesses are adapting or have identified fixes, many of which have been reflected in these proposals. And I don't think the majority of people of any background want to see the politics being allowed to go down this ideological rabbit hole and abstract issues like the ECJ and those being used to prevent a decent offer being adopted and worked through and potentially allowing businesses to get on with their businesses and even maybe being allowed to realise some of the opportunities that the protocol presents.
You're in Westminster. You see the Conservatives as all of this is going on. What is your assessment of the chances of these talks succeeding, given, you know, the fact that Tuesday and Wednesday were completely different takes on the protocol?
Well, quite clearly, there's an element in the UK government that are keen to use the protocol as a mine for grievance, I suppose, a front through which they can keep battling with the EU. We know from Frost's own pronouncement at the Conservative Party conference that he believes that the main issue is that the protocol is largely working and that trade is adapting and that there's an increased north-south trade. And he sees that as a problem. Whereas most people would see, increased prosperity as an opportunity for Northern Ireland, whether or not they are willing to go all the way in terms of, a trade war and so on, there's an acute oversimplification of the issue. People are bandying around the threat to trigger Article 16. But I mean, if you look at the situation in GB, who are in fact grappling with the effects of Northern Ireland, of Brexit, and faring a lot worse than Northern Ireland, there is perhaps a degree to which they don't want to see Northern Ireland stabilised and prospering too much, because it will highlight the loss of single market access at GB businesses and the damage that is happening. But like I say, we have had over 5 years of politicking on this, and businesses have lost so much time trying to respond to proposals, get used to new rules, and for the wider society in Northern Ireland, it has been acutely polarising. All of the things we don't need to talk about that much here around identity and flags and borders are on the political agenda morning, noon and night. And you can see the polarising effect that that's having. It's worth saying the SDLP is acutely aware that there's a particular hurt felt by unionists through, you know, the perception of barriers within the UK. And we're aware of the symbolic impact of borders, but we genuinely believe these proposals from the EU would offer a huge amount of solution in that regard and should be pursued in good faith. It is a worry that some unionist parties in the UK government may wish to sort of keep this on a low boil until the Assembly election and use it for that electoral purpose, and that would be really negative for Northern Ireland.
SDLP MP Claire Hanna, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And that question that Claire Hanna raised, what happens next and what will the fallout be for all of us on this island? Let's hear now from Mushtaba Rahman, who's Managing Director of the Eurasia Group, and he's worked at the EU Commission as well as the UK Treasury. Mushtaba Rahman, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So what's your assessment of where we're at and where this goes?
I mean, I think Lord Frost's front run, Maros Sefcovic's package yesterday in his speech in Lisbon on Tuesday, effectively arguing that regardless of what package is presented, it won't be enough because there's not sufficient movement on this core question now of the European Court of Justice. So I suspect we will have a month of ping pong between the two sides. And at some point, our view certainly is that the government will seek to notify Article 16. And the question really is whether it chooses to do that in a very destructive way or whether it's a bit more constructive about how it seeks to do that.
I mean, so far, Boris Johnson and David Frost have been able to win concessions from the EU, haven't they, on trade? So why isn't it, is it reasonable from their point of view to presume they might be able to get that on the European Court of Justice?
Look, I think Lord Frost is sounding much more reasonable. Certainly his speech in Lisbon, the words were tough, but the tone was soft. So that's created some speculation that there may be a landing zone on the court. But I think the EU line on there is quite firm. I think there's also a lot of ambiguity, frankly, about the government's long-run objectives. I mean, do they actually want to fix these issues in Northern Ireland, or are they seeking domestic political and electoral advantage from an ongoing fight with the EU, which does serve the Tory party's interest on this side, a strong dividing line with the Labour opposition on Europe, where there is a belief in Downing Street that Keir Starmer is vulnerable. You know, there's a question about the extent to which they want to lean into that issue, but do they want Europe to be a focus at the next election? I think yes, they do. So, you know, one can debate what the compromise may be on the ECJ. There are certain precedents in other third countries that could be pointed to. But the real question, I think, is does the UK side want an agreement or not? On that score, I think it's very unclear.
So what would happen, do you think, given those attitudes there and given that it might suit Boris Johnson to be permanently at odds with the EU, even, you know, despite the consequences that might ensue? What could the EU do if Boris Johnson invokes Article 16?
So, look, I think that they're very clear-sighted about what the government is up to. You know, if they choose to fully disapply the protocol, that is on some level a calculation that the Commission will then not force Dublin to resurrect a border on the island of Ireland. Of course, that is the correct calculation. But that does, of course, call into question Ireland's place within the broader single market, because there
we've had a drop out.
Pressure on the need to institute checks.
Sorry, Mushtaba, there was a brief dropout on the line. Continue. Because we're getting to a point that's very interesting from an Irish point of view. So if this escalates and, you know, the issue, the focus is on trade, what happens to Ireland's position in the single market?
Well, I think the UK government is calling that into question, and I think that is very well understood in Brussels. And I frankly don't think, regardless of the economic consequences, the Commission or other member states will allow that kind of pressure to be placed upon Ireland. I think they're absolutely very clear. If the UK side refuses to abide by its commitments regarding the protocol, either in part or in whole, and there is no border on the island of Ireland, of course that puts the Republic under untenable strain regarding its broader membership of the single market. And I think in that context, there is some discussion in Brussels regarding a unilateral suspension of the entire trade agreement. You'll recall and will of course know that negotiations under Michel Barnier were sequenced. They were sequenced for a purpose. The EU wanted to ensure there was a full solution to this question of the Irish border before a trade agreement was signed, and the European Council and the Member States were fully behind that negotiating strategy. So if the UK government is now calling the former, i.e. its commitments under the withdrawal treaty, and if they are seeking to undo those commitments, or they are calling those commitments into question, I think the logical and intellectually coherent response for Europe would be to say the trade agreement also needs to be called into question. So, you know, that is some way off. This is not around the corner. But the mm-hmm. point is that is being discussed at the highest levels of the Commission and in Brussels. And simply that fact that this is being discussed, I think, suggests how seriously Brussels views what the UK government is currently up to.
And the big question that nobody, it appears, can answer at the moment is, in the end, what will Boris Johnson do?
I don't think they know, frankly, and I think we would be wrong to suggest there's a coherent tactical or strategic idea within the number 10 operation or between Boris Johnson and Lord Frost. I don't think they know. I think their view is you lean very hard into this question with a view to extracting as many concessions as you can. They're obviously seeking to do that on the question of trade across the GBNI border. Now they're invoking this question of the ECJ. I think this regime came into power looking at what Theresa May did and looking at how they felt Theresa May was treated, and they drew very different lessons. They think hardball works, and that may be an uncomfortable fact. We may not like that, but I think that's how they want to do business. So I don't think there's a fully signed up, coherent, signed off strategy. I think this is all a bit of a gamble. They're going to lean hard on the question and they're going to see where things land.
Mujtaba Rahman, Managing Director of the Eurasia Group, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland this morning.
As we've been hearing this morning, there is increasing concern about the rising number of people getting infected with and in hospital with COVID-19, and growing doubt over the final easing of restrictions next Friday, despite one of the highest vaccination rates in the world here. The Taoiseach says he can't guarantee a further reopening. We'll hear from the HSE later. Christina Losher is Professor of Immunology at Dublin City University. Good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
We've one of the highest rates of vaccination in the world, but also one of the highest incidents of COVID in Europe right now. Why do you think that is?
So I suppose even though we have a really high vaccination rate, we have opened a lot of the sectors of society over the last 4 to 6 weeks. So we've had a big influx of people into situations where they're mixing with other people, whereas they may not have done that as much over the summer. And we expected that as we opened up during September and October, that our case numbers would go up. But having an increase in case numbers is exactly a surprise, and it still would be less than what would have been predicted in some of the models that were kind of put forward a couple of months ago. So I think our increase in our rates is that essentially we're mixing more. I think we've seen from countries recently like New Zealand, who did really well with COVID, that Delta is very difficult to contain. It's very highly transmissible, and people are starting to move indoors in the last month because of the change in the weather. So I think all of these have contributed to an increase in cases, and mainly it's because our behaviour has changed despite the fact that we are vaccinated. And as Ronan Glynn pointed out yesterday, we still have a very high number of people who aren't vaccinated. So about 370,000 people who don't have two jabs or aren't vaccinated at all.
Yes.
And that's a lot of people in the mix. So if you look at the numbers in hospital and you look at the numbers in ICU, they don't relate to the case numbers in the same way they would have back in March. So we're certainly weakening that link. And most of those are unvaccinated. So, you know, the vaccine is giving us a high level of protection, and those cases are not translating into severe illness and deaths. And that's what vaccination is for.
In your view, should the remaining restrictions be lifted next week?
I think we need to continue.
Hello, Professor Losher.
People have sacrificed. Yes.
Sorry, there was a difficult, a little bit of a breakup with the line there. You were telling us your view about whether the restrictions should be lifted next week.
Yeah, I do think we need to continue with the lifting of restrictions. I think that our case numbers have gone up, and that was to be expected. And I think actually what's happened in the last couple of weeks is that with the 22nd of October very close by, people have probably started to change their behaviour a little bit more aligned with what will happen on the 22nd of October. I do think that everything we do is about mitigating risk. We can't get rid of Delta. You know, New Zealand have proved that. What I would say is that there's one factor that we've had in place that I think mitigates risk and we should potentially think about keeping, and that is the vaccine certs. So de-risking the opening of other indoor environments by keeping vaccine certs, I think that that will probably go a long way to minimising the impact of opening up. But I don't think that we should be not opening up the venues that we've committed to opening up, because we're already mixing an awful lot. There's not a huge amount more that we can do in terms of mixing. People are socialising again. They're back in work. They're back in the office. They're back in college. They're back in schools. So I think continuing with mitigating risk is probably what we should focus on. And I would keep the vaccine certs. I would again remind people about the benefits of mask wearing and hand sanitising. I myself have seen those have started to decrease a little bit. So I think we need to refocus on the mitigating risk factors.
And we'll talk to a nightclub owner a little bit later on in the programme. Can many, many more people expect to get infected with the virus over the winter? Do we need to accept that?
I think we need to accept that people get sicker in the winter in general. And, you know, people present more to their GPs and will come down with an illness in the wintertime in general. And that's basically because people are mixing in indoor, closed-in environments that aren't ventilated. And that's the way we've lived, you know, for most of our lives. So I think that that's to be expected. And I think that what we've seen over the last couple of months is that the wall of vaccination and the protection that offers has stopped the case number progressing to hospitalisation and severe illness and deaths. And I think that if people do get COVID and are vaccinated over the winter, they're likely to be a mild illness that they might have experienced in another winter, maybe with the flu or a severe cold. But I do think that, you know, we are going to expect case numbers to increase potentially over the winter. But we are getting to the stage where there's so many people vaccinated. There's not a huge amount of more people to actually become infected that aren't vaccinated. So at some stage that will level off.
Professor Christina Loscher, Professor of Immunology at TCU, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
It's 24 minutes to 8 and Damien's here with the sports news. Good morning, Damien.
Good morning to you. We're going to begin with cricket. Ireland's men continuing their preparations this morning ahead of the start of the T20 World Cup, which gets underway next week. They're currently in action against Bangladesh in Abu Dhabi. Play began at 7 o'clock. Ireland won the toss. They chose to bat. They're currently 64-1 off 7 overs. Police in Kenya investigating the murder of the long-distance runner Agnes Tirop have confirmed that her husband is being treated as a suspect. The 25-year-old was found dead in her home yesterday after suffering stab wounds. An investigation is ongoing with her husband's whereabouts currently unknown. Tirop finished fourth in the 5,000 metres at the recent Tokyo Olympics. She twice won bronze medals at the World Championships and last month broke the world record for the women's 10K. In Gaelic games, Keith Ricken is set to replace Ronan McCarthy as the Cork senior football manager. The St Vincent's clubman managed the county's under-20s to an All-Ireland in 2019 and a Munster title this year. He's been proposed for a 2-year term by a county board selection committee. The Gaelic Players Association have written to delegates ahead of the GAA's upcoming special congress, reiterating their desire to see the passing of Proposal B, which would see the football championship adopt a league-based structure. They say they have taken the step after Chief Executive Tom Parsons was not allowed to represent the views of the playing base at a recent online Central Council meeting. Now, sport, like so many other aspects of society, is analysing the impact of Budget 2020 on its activities. activities. The headline from a government briefing yesterday is an increase of €4.3 million to €96.2 million in funding for Sport Ireland. Also included is the expected but long-awaited introduction of parity of funding between male and female GAA players. Previously, there was a shortfall of around €800 per annum, with male players receiving €1,200, females €400. That's now been equalised. The former Tyrone footballer Gemma Begley, who's the player representation and engagement manager with the GPA, has been reacting to yesterday's news and the long campaign towards equality.
It's probably really since the inception of the grants in 2015 for the female players, I suppose, was when it was first brought to life. There's always been a recognition that alongside, I suppose, team costs, that the players were out of pocket themselves. That's where the evolution of the female grants have come from. Previously, it was just team funding, and now I suppose we're able to help players as well. It was perfect timing, if you like, with the amalgamation of the GPA and WGPA. It's written into the new association that one of the key pillars is to deliver equality of recognition, opportunity and investment. So it's something we're very passionate about and delighted to see it recognised by the state and Sport Ireland in support of that. And it's great to continue, I suppose, to work closely with the LGFA and Camogie and the GA on that.
Ronnie O'Sullivan has moved to clarify comments which were interpreted as criticism of fans present at the ongoing Northern Ireland Open in Belfast. Speaking last night, he explained that his observations on the atmosphere were directed at tournament organisers and the logistics of how they've built the arena at the Waterfront Hall and not those watching on. Mark Allen plays Matthew Stevens in the second round later on this morning. Republic of Ireland international Leanne Kiernan scored Liverpool's equaliser last night in their 1-1 draw with Aston Villa in the FA Women's League Cup. Liverpool went on to win the game on penalties. Kiernan came on as a sub in the 63rd minute, scored in the 67th, but then was forced off injured in the 73rd. Megan Connolly scored for Brighton in their 1-0 win over Birmingham City. The Irish manager Vera Powell will name her squad tomorrow ahead of the start next week of the Republic of Ireland's World Cup qualification campaign. Jonathan Caldwell is the only Irish player in the field at the European Tour's Andalusia Masters. Play gets underway there this morning. Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry will both be in action at the PGA Tour's CJ Cup, which is in Las Vegas this week. And racing at home today is in the Curragh from 12:40. The card in Tramore is away from 1 o'clock, and more sport available on the RT News app and also the RT Sport website.
To Norway now, where 5 people were killed and 2 injured when a man attacked them with a bow and arrow. The shocking event happened in the town of Kongsberg, southwest of Oslo. The suspect has been arrested. Police Chief Ervind Ass spoke to reporters last night.
I can confirm that we have had a serious incident in the centre of Kongsberg tonight. At 18:13, the police got several reports of a man moving around with a weapon, with a bow and arrows. We can confirm that several are injured and there are fatalities. The injured have been brought to hospital for treatment. The municipality has been notified and declared an emergency and will assist those who need it. The perpetrator has been caught, and we aren't looking for more people now. With the information we have, we now believe he did this on his own.
And let's hear more now from Oslo-based journalist Tom Christiansen. Tom, take us through events as they unfolded, these horrific events in Kongsberg last night.
It was a shocking thing in this little town where all people know each other. He popped up in a food store with a bow and arrow, and people thought it was some toys. But then he started shooting, and he shot 5 people, as we have heard. Police has now established that this is a Danish citizen. He has been living in Kongsberg. He's known by the police. And it's also known by the health service, meaning that he might have some mental disturbances. Police has been interested to know if this was a terror act. What are his reasons for this? But so far we haven't got that from him.
What's known about the 5 fatalities and also those injured?
The names have not been known so far. And that is what the whole community there at the moment is wondering. Who are they? Are the people that we know? And the kids are on the way to school, and the police will be at school to explain what has happened. But the shock in the city is that are any of these pupils in relation to those who are killed, or do they know them? It's traumatizing for the whole community.
And you say the suspect who's been arrested was known by the police and the health service. But whatever the motive, whatever the reason, it's terrifying, isn't it, for the community, an attack like this, particularly with a weapon like a bow and arrow, which seems utterly bizarre.
Police also say that he might have had other weapons than... And I have heard the rumours that he also has stabbed a woman with a knife.
And what will happen? You say the police are going to the schools today. Talk to us about the political reaction today and how the investigation will continue.
The political reactions here are very, very strong, and all resources from the police, including the terror units, has been sent to Kongsberg. It's a very special day in Norway because we are changing government this at noon today, so which is as a great event, but this day that will be story number two in the society. What the politician can do here is to see that all resources are set to go to Kongsberg to help the local police.
All right, and thank you for filling us in on all of that. That's journalist Tom Christiansen in Oslo.
Cabinet jitters are mentioned in the lead headline of the Irish Independent. The paper says that the government is bracing for a delay in removing the remaining COVID-19 restrictions after a sudden change in the behaviour of the virus caused alarm among public health officials. As 2,066 new cases were reported yesterday, senior figures from the National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, told government officials of concerns over the rise in the number of tests carried out, the positivity rate and hospitalisations, the paper says. "We are not out of the woods," says the Irish Daily Mail, summing up the cautious words of the Taoiseach on the subject yesterday. Meanwhile, farmers are scathing about the budget. "It exposes this government's lack of commitment to farmers and rural Ireland," writes Justin McCarthy in an editorial in the Irish Farmers Journal. The Irish Times leads with the new proposals from the European Commission designed to ease the implementation of Northern Ireland's post-Brexit arrangements. The paper says that the offer to drop most checks on goods from Britain destined for Northern Ireland's supermarket shelves and cut half of the customs formalities was based on discussions with local, civic and business figures. Naomi O'Leary reports on the opposition that Maroš Šefčovič, the EU's Brexit point man, faced in making his proposals. And she quotes a diplomat as saying, "The Commission is pushing at the very edge of what is accepted by member states." The Irish Examiner leads with the statement by the Garda Commissioner Drew Harris that in light of the Sarah Everard murder case in London, he is setting up a review of investigations where Gardaí are accused of domestic or sexual violence to make sure they are investigated properly. The Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star lead with reports on a man they both describe as a Kinahan hitman who flew into Ireland in 2017 and was caught on CCTV strolling through Dublin before being arrested. As the papers report, an image from the CCTV footage features in an RTE primetime show tonight. The Irish Sun leads with a report on the inquest on a young woman who died of a blood clot hours after being discharged from University Hospital Limerick in 2019, in which the coroner gave a verdict of medical misadventure. The front page picture in the Examiner is of students outside the Dublin City Council offices yesterday, protesting about comments made by the Council Chief Executive Owen Keegan about student accommodation. But as is reported inside the Examiner and in other papers, Mr. Keegan has apologised for his remarks made in a letter to UCD Students' Union. He had said that he was surprised that the union had not entered the housing market itself after it had complained that private interests were ripping off students for excess profits. In another letter to the student union published yesterday, Mr. Keegan said the use of sarcasm was inappropriate and he was happy to apologise for the offence caused. But Owen Keegan is not the only one to suggest that people get into the housing market. In the Times property supplement, there is an article with the unsarcastic headline, How to Make Money from Your Garden. If your home has a large garden, you may be sitting on some money, writes Joanne Hunt. Selling a site, developing it yourself or gifting it to a family member are all ways to monetize what's under your nose.
If there was one dominant theme influencing the budgetary measures announced on Tuesday, it was inflation, which is being driven primarily by rising energy prices. But it's not a problem that's unique to Ireland. The EU is hoping to come up with continent-wide solutions to help combat surging energy prices. James Waddell is Senior Global Gas Analyst with Energy Aspects. And one of the suggested solutions, James, is the joint purchase of gas by countries in an attempt to counter soaring prices. How might that work, and is it a potential solution?
Well, this is not the first time that this type of measure has been proposed at the European Union level. It is a case where individual member states could group together to try and purchase gas as a bloc. The thing is that it wouldn't have helped necessarily in this winter. It's certainly not going to be something that can be imposed for this winter to reduce prices. It effectively transfers the burden of energy purchases onto the taxpayer rather than let market signals feed through into demand destruction in the market as such. So it's not really a potential for, solution for high prices that we're seeing at the moment.
So too late for this winter, perhaps. So how long might we be looking at rising energy prices? There's some hope of a reprieve maybe by next spring. Are we likely to get away with just one expensive winter?
So what everyone is really counting on is getting more Russian gas into the European balance. That has been the one major line item that's been missing from European supply this year. Russia's been saying it's been selling more, but it's been selling a lot more to Turkey specifically, and selling a lot more out of its destination storage held within Europe rather than delivering gas across the border. If we start to see a resumption in Russian gas coming into Europe next year, that should start to ease prices down significantly from today's levels.
And Vladimir Putin yesterday rejected suggestions that Russia had been withholding supply in order to push up prices in Europe. Has it?
The issue is that Russia's been selling a lot more to the Turkish market. There is actually an accounting difference in terms of how Russia classifies its sales to what it calls the far abroad. So a lot has been going into the Turkish balance. A lot has been going into Russia itself. Some actually has been going to Europe, but it hasn't really been sending that across the border. So actually, it has been well below pre-pandemic levels, while demand has been recovering to a pre-pandemic baseline. So that is, it has been tightening the market.
Of course, the ideal is that we eventually wean ourselves off gas as a source of energy for electricity generation and for heating in favour of renewable sources. But the reality is we're going to be reliant on gas for quite a while yet, surely.
That's true. It's just taking time to fulfill the energy transition. At the same time, we're also closing a lot of coal-fired capacity across Europe and a lot of nuclear capacity. Now, normally, when the gas market is very tight, you would get more coal-fired generation feeding into the balance. And we have seen that to some extent. But because the global coal market is so tight, it's not able to provide that sort of backup that we would normally expect. So this is why we're getting this drive up in gas prices. And also, you know, across Europe, we have had this big closure of nuclear capacity, particularly in Germany, which is also adding to concerns about how much spare generation we have. And it's forcing gas to do more to generate in the meantime. So it's going to take some time for renewables to really take over from gas-fired generation.
James Waddell, Senior Global Gas Analyst with Energy Aspects, thank you.
After almost 600 days, will the final restrictions on our lives because of the pandemic be lifted as planned next Friday? The Taoiseach says he can't guarantee a further reopening, and there are increasing concerns over the rise in the number of people getting infected with and in hospital with COVID-19. Over 400 people are in hospital with the virus, and over 2,000 cases were reported again yesterday, despite three-quarters of the population being fully vaccinated. The Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have been telling meetings of their parliamentary parties that the numbers are worrying, going in the wrong direction, and the decisions will be made over the coming days. Anne O'Connor is Chief Operations Officer with the HSE, and she's with us now. Anne O'Connor, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
What's your understanding of why, when three-quarters of the population are fully vaccinated, that so many people are getting the virus and so many are getting sick?
I think, Gavin, you know, in terms of the vaccination programme, as you said, we are very well advanced on that with very high uptake levels. However, And I think you've already covered this. You know, we know that there are about 300,000 adults who are completely unvaccinated and about 70,000 who are partially vaccinated. Equally, we know that there will always be a level of, I suppose, a number of people who won't be fully protected by the vaccine. And that's why it's really important that as many people get it as possible so that we reduce that risk. But what we can see in terms of people coming into hospital, so the people who are getting sick from COVID are being disproportionately, I suppose, the numbers are disproportionate in terms of those who are unvaccinated. So if you think there's about 10% of the adult population who are unvaccinated, and they're currently driving about 50% of all of our admissions. So even though it's a lower percentage, it's a much higher number then in terms of the people who are being admitted to hospital who are sick, and indeed who are going into ICU, where about two-thirds of the people there are unvaccinated. So it's really, you know, I think it's really important that people understand that that's why we're driving out boosters to older people, to the general population, to people in long-term care facilities, and why we're giving a third dose of the vaccine to people who are immunocompromised, just to reduce that risk.
I'll come back to the people who are in hospital with the virus shortly, but what's your understanding of whether children, particularly young children who won't have been vaccinated, to what extent they're pushing up the case numbers at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the cases, we can see that the cases are growing. And I know that, you know, when we look back at the past week, it has been, I suppose, a rising number. And we can see that certainly the 14-day average is growing. And that's a concern for us. The numbers in terms of the actual number of cases, they're up 43% on the previous week. So we can see that. And about 26% of those are in the 0 to 18 years. So there is a significant number. The highest numbers in the 19 to 44 years, though, at just under 40%. So, you know, in reality, the case numbers are going up in younger, in adult populations, and we are seeing cases in the older population. But the biggest numbers would be in that 19 to 44 and the 0 to 18.
Of the people who are in hospital with the virus, do you know what proportion of them are vaccinated?
I think in terms of the numbers that are vaccinated, we know that about two-thirds of people in ICU are unvaccinated. We know also that there's a number. So in terms of the non-ICU, it's less. It's about 30-something percent. Sorry, I don't have that number just in front of me. But I think that, you know, I suppose the really important thing for us is the number of people who become very sick. In relation to the vaccine, we know that the vaccine will reduce the risk of people becoming very sick. So even though people are testing positive, the reality for us in terms of health service delivery is that the sicker people become, they put, a greater demand on health services and indeed on our ICU capacity. And that's what we're starting to see.
And do you know what proportion have the virus but are in hospital for a different reason?
No, I don't have that detail. I mean, I think and certainly what we find is that when somebody is in hospital, I suppose for us in terms of the impact on the health services, once they are COVID positive or indeed suspected of being COVID positive, the intervention and the pathway for them in the hospital has to be one where we believe they have COVID. So if somebody presents to our emergency department, and anybody who has been there in the last year and a half will know that we now have a red ED and a green ED. So people are streamed depending on whether they are suspected of being COVID positive. And for us, in terms of health service delivery, that means that we in effect have to keep two systems running. So one system for people who are COVID positive and one system for people who aren't.
Why are hospitals so busy at the moment?
I think there's a range of reasons, Gavin. So, you know, we are heading into the winter period, which is a time when we would always see increased activity. But what we're seeing this year is a very, very high level of attendance at our emergency departments. We know that, you know, we have seen in recent months, since the real peaks of COVID have settled down, more people have started to present to our emergency departments. And our attendances now are really very high. So we know that they are up significantly on last year and indeed on the previous year. So last year was kind of an unusual year. But even compared to 2019, in some of our sites, they're up 25% in terms of attendances. I think the important thing for us then is to see how many of those people are admitted to hospital. And a changing picture for us in the recent weeks has been that more people are needing admission to hospital. In general, when people present to our emergency departments, about one in every four is admitted. When you get to older people, that's one in every two. But what we've seen in the last week, you know, on average over the last 8 weeks, our admissions would be at about 6,000 per week. In the last week, that's gone up to 6,500. So more sick people turning up who need to be admitted to hospital for a whole range of reasons, including increased frailty and people who are just sicker.
And with over 400 people now in hospital with COVID, at what stage, at what number will other services have to be cut back, operations and appointments be cancelled?
Well, I think in some sites we're seeing a bit of that already, to be honest. Some of our models, so four sites, they'd be our big hospitals, particularly in Galway, Limerick, Cork. They are very challenged to continue to deliver all services as it stands. So their hospitals are full. Across our whole system last night, we had less than 100 beds available. And that will impact on a day-by-day basis in any surge. So whether it's to do with COVID or a flu season, we know that sometimes we have to scale back on other activity. And that will happen on a site-by-site basis. So we only have a certain number of beds in our system at the minute. It's just under 12,000. And when they are full, we can't take more people in. It's a real capacity and demand thing. But we know that that is a potential. So sites will be making that decision on a day-by-day basis at the minute.
If the remaining restrictions are lifted as planned next week, what effect do you think that's going to have on people getting sick because of the virus and ending up in hospital?
Look, I mean, I think that, you know, I know that government will be making that decision next week and will be guided by NPHET. In terms of our health service delivery, we are concerned around the level of activity, both in relation to COVID and non-COVID at the minute. We still have around 400 people in hospital with COVID, which is a fairly stubborn number. It's in or around 400 now for some time. And certainly our ICU capacity is very stretched. As we head towards winter, there is a chance this year that we will have a flu season. We didn't have that last year because people weren't mixing as much. But that will put a significant demand on top of everything else within our services. So we are concerned. And I suppose from our perspective, we urge people to be vaccinated. We know that the risk comes down when people are vaccinated. We urge people to get the flu vaccine. Equally, we know that that has a significant impact on the number of people who will present. So for us, it is about people being cautious. It is about people remembering the basic public health messages. And really, you know, okay. People, I suppose, take responsibility for that.
And with 17,000 tests carried out on Monday and more than 10,000 most days this week and in recent weeks, do you expect that scale of testing to be needed throughout the winter?
We're certainly maintaining that level of capacity. I mean, as you say, 17,000 tests a day is still a very high number in terms of testing. We will continue that throughout the winter and into early 2022. And we'll continue it, Gavin, for as long as it's needed. That capacity is there and it will remain there okay. For as long as it's needed.
Anne O'Connor, Chief Operations Officer with the HSE. Thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
And the time now, 23 minutes to 9. Damien's back with more sports news.
Anya, good morning to you again. It's cricket to start, where Ireland's men continue their preparations this morning ahead of the start of the T20 World Cup, which gets underway next week. They face Bangladesh in Abu Dhabi. Play got underway at 7 o'clock. Ireland won the toss they chose to bat. They're currently 155 for 3 after 18 overs. Police in Kenya investigating the murder of the long-distance runner Agnes Tirop have confirmed that her husband is being treated as a suspect. The 25-year-old was found dead in her home yesterday after suffering stab wounds. An investigation is ongoing, with her husband's whereabouts currently unknown. Tirop finished fourth in the 5,000 metres at the recent Tokyo Olympics, having twice won bronze medals at the World Championships. Last month, she broke the world record for the women's 10K. Keith Ricken is set to replace Ronan McCarthy as the Cork senior football manager. The St Vincent's clubman managed the county's under-20s to an All-Ireland title in 2019 and a Munster title this year. He's been proposed for a two-year term by a county board selection committee. The Gaelic Players Association have written to delegates ahead of the GAA's upcoming special congress, reiterating their desire to see the passing of Proposal B, which would see the football championship adopt a league-based structure. They say they have taken the step after CEO Tom Parsons was not allowed to represent the views of the playing base at a recent online central council meeting. Republic of Ireland international Leanne Kiernan scored Liverpool's equaliser last night in their 1-1 draw with Aston Villa in the FA Women's League Cup. Liverpool won the game on penalties. She came on as a sub in the 63rd minute. She scored in the 67th and then was forced off injured in the 73rd. Megan Connolly scored for Brighton in their 1-0 win over Birmingham City. The Irish manager Vera Powell will name her squad tomorrow ahead of the start next week of the Republic of Ireland's World Cup qualification campaign. Now, a week on from the Premier League approving its takeover by the Saudi Arabia-backed public investment funds, there continues to be very strong focus focus on Newcastle United and the perceived suitability of their new owners. Amnesty International yesterday renewed calls for a meeting with football authorities to discuss changes to the Premier League's owners and directors tests. They and a number of groups have raised concerns around human rights records in the country. It's emerged yesterday that Manchester United, Everton and Tottenham Hotspur also strongly opposed the deal in a meeting of Premier League clubs. The former Republic of Ireland international John Anderson is now working as a broadcaster with BBC Radio Newcastle. He covers the club on a weekly basis and is with me. Morning to you, John.
Morning, Damien.
This has really intensified again over the last 24 hours. So much scrutiny, really justifiable questions around human rights records. You speak to the fans on a daily basis through your role with the BBC. Realistically, how much of a focus is there amongst the grassroots on the suitability of the new owners?
Not a great deal, if I'm perfectly honest, Damien, to be quite honest. Supporters are focusing on the fact that they are now probably the richest club in the world, but one or two feel that they're being victimised. They feel that other clubs being run by certain individuals should be looked at as well, and that's not being mentioned. So they just feel that at this moment in time they're being a little bit victimised, if I'm perfectly honest.
And is there a universal welcome, or has anyone spoken out at all about the suitability?
One or two have spoken out, but the majority of supporters are absolutely delighted with it. They've had 14 years of mediocrity, and probably less than mediocrity, if I'm perfectly honest. They wanted Mike Ashley out. This ongoing saga of the takeover has been going on for about 4 years now. So the fact that it's happened, everybody's elated, if I'm perfectly honest. Mm. I mean, you can't get a ticket for love nor money for the Spurs game on Sunday, the Chelsea game in 2 weeks' time, that's already sold out as well. So there's just so much excitement up here. They see a real, real bright future.
We've seen quite the PR campaign by the new owners towards the fan base,
yeah,
over the last week, as tends to be the case in situations like this. Steve Bruce is due to take charge of his 1,000th game in management this weekend. Is part of that PR offensive going to result in his departure from the club before that game on Sunday?
You're right about the PR offensive, there's no doubt about that. I would imagine that Steve Bruce will be gone before Sunday. From what we've been led to believe, Steve Bruce has been taking training. He has met Amanda Staveley, but what we've been told is that it needs to be signed off. His dismissal needs to be signed off by the PIF in Saudi, and as of yet, that hasn't been done. And once that's finalised, Steve Bruce will no longer be manager of Newcastle United.
And all sorts of names are being discussed and linked with the job, from Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard, all sorts of big names within the world of football. But realistically, if a Newcastle side that's taken 3 points from 7 games, it's very difficult in footballing terms, despite the money that's involved, to see an influx of big names in the January transfer window or next summer, or a manager that's going to want to come in and fight against relegation.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned that no wins this season. It's 7 wins in the last 37 games, if you want to break it down, you know. So I think this is a decision where they will take their time. I don't think they're going to rush into it. They know that it's a big, big decision to make. It's a decision that they've got to get right.
Okay.
I think Graeme Jones will come in, will be given the job on a temporary basis until they find the man that they want.
He's the assistant at the minute. John, thanks so much for your time. John Anderson with us there. Ronnie O'Sullivan has moved to clarify comments which were interpreted as criticism of fans' presence at the Northern Ireland Open in Belfast. He says his observations on the atmosphere were directed at organisers and the logistics of how the tournament has been set up. Jonathan Caldwell's the only Irish player in the field at the European Tours Andalusia Masters, which has got underway in the past hour. And racing at home today is at the Curragh from 12:40, the card in Tramore away from 1 o'clock.
Far-reaching and welcome the reaction of Sinn Féin to the EU's proposals to drop most checks on goods and medicines from the UK to Northern Ireland in a bid to resolve the row about the protocol with the UK. Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill joins us now to talk about this. Good morning to you, Michelle O'Neill.
Good morning, Anya.
So you've given it a welcome and you're meeting Maros Šefčovič today, but you heard Geoffrey Donaldson saying yesterday it's far short of what's needed, and also Doug Beattie talking about loyalist opposition and the risk of protests that could turn to violence. What's your assessment of the divided reaction to the EU proposals?
Well, the DUP have continued to be the outlier when it comes to the issue of Brexit, of course. Brexit is a problem and the protocol is a solution. So I do very much welcome what's been tabled yesterday by the European Union. I think it demonstrates that they actually listen to local stakeholders, they listen to the issues that were raised by the local business community, and they've provided practical solutions to make the protocol work. So I think that whilst obviously there's a bit of a journey still to travel in terms of getting this all tied down, but I do think that it demonstrates that there are one of the solutions to be found, that the EU will not be found wanting. So I think that more what we've witnessed yesterday from the DUP is more of the same, and it begs the question as to whether or not they really do want the certainty and stability that the rest of us are trying to work together to achieve. I think what's going on within the DUP is more about division within unionism itself. It's more about internal issues within the DUP. It's more about declining popularity in the polls, and it's more about an upcoming election.
And you say that yesterday's proposals shows the EU will not be found wanting and seeking compromise and trying to sort this out. On the other hand, doesn't it also show to the UK government that if you play hardball, you can win concessions from the EU, even if you're being told it's impossible? So why wouldn't they believe the same, for instance, about their red line on the European Court of Justice?
Well, I mean, I think the British government have demonstrated unbridled duplicity. I mean, they keep moving the goalposts. And we have a new red line this week in terms of the European Court of Justice that has not been an issue to this point. I think that the North in particular will be in use as a pawn in a battle between the British government and the EU. And that's not good enough. It's not acceptable for our local economy. It's not acceptable for local businesses. And I think yesterday's proposals demonstrate that within the framework of the protocol, there were always going to be things that needed to be ironed out because of the lateness of the deal. And we found a way to do that. So I think that what was being called upon or being asked of the EU, they've delivered. And now it's time for it to actually get this all tied down and actually give the certainty and stability that the local business community and that all of us actually in the North want to achieve. Mm-hmm. These are sensible solutions. It's a bespoke arrangement to make the protocol work. So those that are speaking about binning the protocol, that's not even an option. It's not on the table. It's an international treaty and it needs to be delivered upon.
But so far, if you're Boris Johnson playing hardball, gambling, daring the EU to, you know, fall out with you, it's worked so far, hasn't it? And it may be in his political interest to continue along those lines.
But I think that demonstrates how sincere Boris Johnson and the Tories are actually about the best interests of the people who live on this island. I think that the fact that they do keep moving the goalposts does beg that question as to whether or not they actually really do want to find a way through here. I mean, Boris Johnson signed up to this withdrawal agreement. He signed up to the protocol. He signed an international treaty. And ever since that, before the ink was even dry in that agreement, he has tried to backtrack and come out of that. So I don't think that bodes well for where we are. However, I can only work with what I have in front of me today, which is these proposals from the EU side, which I think can provide us a way forward within the protocol, because we have to fight tooth and nail to maintain the protocol, because it gives us the protections of no hard border on this island, protects the whole island economy, and really crucially protects the Good Friday Agreement, our peace agreement.
And has the EU gone far enough in addressing what unionists have been very concerned about and what Claire Hannah was telling us earlier? She understands the democratic deficit where Northern Ireland had very little say about the rules that were coming from the EU about it.
Well, and again, the protocol is an agreement between both the EU side and the British government. And of course, we in the local assembly have a role to play, and we will engage with the European Union. I welcome the fact that they have put forward proposals in terms of engagement with this assembly, but also engagement with the local business community. I think that's also really important. So I think that really you have to, there's a lot of questions, I suppose, that we would need to ask, particularly of Federal Unionism and particularly of the DUP. I am not convinced that they have the best interests of the public at heart. I believe that what's happening on their political posture and their positioning is more about the internal challenges. Obviously, they're in internal turmoil within the party itself, but also it's about the division of support across the unionist parties. And I think that with the rise in the Democrat or the TUV, with the decline in support for the unionist parties in the polls, and again, they are, you know, posturing in terms of threatening stability of politics in the North and asking for an election. So I think it's more about those things than it really is about trying to find a considered way forward here that allows us to maintain the protection that we have within the protocol and actually start to provide certainty and stability, because we have had such instability because of the Brexit debate for the last 5 years, and now we have a way forward. And I would it's been warmly welcomed, just to say, Anya, it's been warmly welcomed by the business community.
Yeah,
they're all cautiously optimistic in terms of it being a solution.
I want to ask you one other issue, of course, that's top of the political agenda at the moment, Michelle O'Neill, and it's the same north and south, rising COVID rates and hospitalisations. 1,417 cases there in Northern Ireland yesterday, 374 in hospital, 33 in intensive care. And more restrictions being eased from today and more to come on the 31st. Is it going in the right direction?
We have to keep a very cautious eye on the figures. I mean, obviously, there seems to be, or we're going through a period of sustained high levels of cases. However, our hospitalisation rates are starting to fall ever so slightly. So we have to watch the data very carefully, and we continue to monitor that and then take decisions accordingly. We have the, today marks another stage where we're able to lift some of the restrictions, particularly around domestic settings, but
up to 30 indoors, is that right? And audiences no longer have to stay seated.
Yes, that's correct. And we have another lifting of restrictions at the end of the month, but we've said that we want to keep making progress, but we have to be very, very cautious because our health systems are obviously are very much stretched at the moment, and I think we're in for a very uncertain winter, and we need to be very, very careful.
And again, should there be, you know, concerns about things going in the wrong direction as the weeks go by, would you be calling for a return of restrictions, masking, COVID passes, that kind of thing?
Well, we're working very much in partnership with all the different sectors. We're trying to find ways to do things that provides the least disruption to people's lives, but obviously protects our health service and protects the public at large. So we're working up a system. We will have a system good to go at the end of the month in terms of certification if we needed to go there. But we want to avoid going there if we can. We want to work in partnership, making things voluntary, working with sectors, continuing that engagement, but then monitoring the data very carefully. So very much I think we're in the stage of partnership working, particularly with, for example, hospitality, who's been, you know, and tourism sector, who've been very, very hard hit throughout the last 18 months with the pandemic. And I think that for us, certainly, the approach that we're trying to take at this moment in time is a partnership one, where we're not enforcing strict rules on people, and we hope to avoid that ever being the case again, that we never get back into the scenario where we have lockdown scenarios.
And indeed, we'll be hearing from hospitality and nightclubs later in the programme. For the moment, Michelle O'Neill, Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister, thank you for speaking to us on Morning Ireland.
The plan is to lift the remaining restrictions because of the pandemic next Friday. That means an end to physical distancing, mask wearing, except in healthcare shops and on public transport, an end to limits on numbers at indoor and outdoor events and activities, restrictions on religious or civil ceremonies, limits on numbers that can meet in private homes and gardens, certificates of vaccination except for travelling abroad, and restrictions on high-risk activities like nightclubs. But as we've been hearing, because of concerns over a rise in the number of people infected with and in hospital with the virus, the Taoiseach says he can't guarantee a further reopening next Friday. Our reporter Angus Cox has been to Bray in County Wicklow this morning to find out what people think about a potential delay.
It wouldn't bother me. I work in a nursing home, one of the very few that had no COVID cases, and I would rather restrict things until things are completely safe to keep, well, from my perspective, to keep the residents safe and my grandparents and things like that.
If it's delayed, I wouldn't be too happy about it, you know, because I'm looking forward to things going back to normal. But, you know, safety first, I suppose. Whatever they have to do to keep the numbers down and to help people, make sure nobody's getting sick or dying or anything, you know.
What can you do? They're not doing it for no reason, do you know what I mean?
How do you feel the public would react if the Taoiseach says we're going to have to push this back?
I'd say they'd go mad, definitely. They'd go mad.
I'm definitely worried about the rise in case numbers. The vaccinations were supposed to fix all this, and we were thinking we were getting there. The numbers started to go down, and it looked like we were on top of things. But now that the case numbers go up, you know, we're a bit worried about where it's going.
I wouldn't have a problem with it. Safety comes first. I think it's reasonable to expect a delay if cases keep coming up. I don't think anyone could really have a problem with that.
And are you worried about what we're seeing with the trends in case numbers, hospitalisations lately?
It is a bit worrying seeing the numbers go up, but with most people vaccinated, it tends to take the edge off the worry a little bit, although there are a big pool of people still unvaccinated for a variety of reasons. It's on them, really.
People in Bray in County Wicklow with our reporter Angus Cox this morning. Let's speak to Ian Redmond. He's the operator of Tramline Nightclub in Dublin City Centre. Ian, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
We'll talk about next weekend in a moment. How long have you been closed?
19 months, 83 weeks or 581 days. to be accurate.
Oh my goodness. So what had you planned for next weekend?
We had a full kind of lineup of events. We started working on this kind of 6 weeks ago, and we hired all our staff back, our management and all our floor staff and our bar staff. And our plans for next weekend were we're going to put on a live band from 7 p.m. in our venue and invite the industry and trade and thank them for their patience in dealing with us. Like, our creditors have just been fantastic. Then we've sold 900 tickets for an event for 18 to 20 year olds for the Friday night to run from 10:30 till 2:30. Same with Saturday. We've Abbesque, a tribute band, on for Saturday from 7 to 10. And then another dance night for 18 to 21-year-olds with another 900 tickets sold. And right the way through the week, we've junior discos for the midterm break for 14 and 15-year-olds, all sold out. And we're just devastated now, the amount of work that's gone into this, Gavin.
Now, are you worried that you won't reopen now next weekend?
Absolutely. I just want certainty. I want clarity from our government. We deserve that at this stage. We've been closed that long. Tell us we can open or tell us we can't open. But to put in restrictions to say, oh, you can open to 50% or 60%, like just some ad hoc number, it just doesn't work. Mr. Martin knows well that our business only works when we can trade at capacity, and she has said that yesterday. So she understands. And Taoiseach needs to realise that, well, either like leave us closed or get us open. We need certainty, and to leave it to the very last minute, Tuesday or Wednesday of next week, it's just not fair. We've rosters written for staff for next week. You know, we need certainty.
What would you think of using COVID passes?
Fine. Like, we've been involved with some events over the last couple of weeks, some of our staff, and you're getting vaccine rates of 95 to 97% of people turning up at these events. So that's fine. So really, the people who want to go nightclubbing or out to parties, by and large, they're fully vaccinated. So there's no problem in people producing a COVID passport, or even just getting a thermometer check on the way in, you know, laser. Yeah, you're ground under 37 degrees Celsius. That seems fine. So that and that. But now to start introducing antigen testing would be absolutely ridiculous in our mind, like so late after dissing, putting down Neffin and not agreeing with antigen testing for so long, to actually introduce it. It would be crazy. You know, the logistics of running antigen testing at an event like that with 1,000 kids queuing up to go into a nightclub, you know, it just wouldn't work.
Ian Redman, thanks for speaking to us. That's Ian runs the Tramline nightclub in Dublin City Centre. We're also joined by Adrian Cummins, he's CEO of the Restaurants Association. Good morning again, Adrian. What were you expecting to change from next Friday for restaurants?
Good morning, Gavin. Well, we would expect from next Friday that all restrictions would be removed for indoor hospitality, that we would effectively come back to normal trading hours, normal operating environment, no social distancing internally, no time limits, back to pre-COVID levels of trading capacity for our industry. The difference between now and a number of months ago is that we have the COVID passport in place that's working well. We will always take public health advice. We've always said that throughout the pandemic. But the clock is ticking down now to tomorrow week, where bookings have been taken by industry across the country, the table of six more bookings can be taken as well. So we need clarity as soon as possible. Okay. Our lines of engagement are open with the government, so we need to have direct contact now as soon as possible with the government around this.
As I mentioned to Ian there, and we were talking to Professor Losher at DCU earlier, she thinks that COVID passes could be extended and reopening could go ahead. What do you think?
Well, we have operated with COVID passports since August of this year. The difference between now and a number of months ago is that the COVID pass allows us to trade safely internally with those that are vaccinated or those that are recovering from COVID. And we adopted the NEFIT recommendation last August, and it has worked well. It is
labour-intensive. And would you be happy for them to work a bit longer?
Well, if that allows us to open up internally with no social distancing, back to normal trading environment, back to normal trading hours, more to the point, we would be very happy to move forward over the next number of months so that we can protect our customers and protect the health of the nation also.
things change very quickly. I mean, we were talking to, or rather the News at One were talking to Professor Philip Nolan last week, who said at that stage that he didn't see anything in the numbers that they were seeing that would prevent reopening from happening next Friday. Now there's increased caution because of a change in direction in the numbers in the last week. You'll know by Monday or Tuesday for certain. Is that time enough?
Well, we'll know on Monday night because Neffet will make the recommendation to the three leaders of the coalition government. I think that will, you know, as normal, that will be leaked out and we will know from Monday night. But Neffet know already the trajectory of this this virus from their modelling already. And I think that the government needs to engage with hospitality because we've rostered in staff now from next Friday onwards. And some of those staff, from especially in the nighttime economy, have been taken off the pub. And if we can't open beyond 11:30, which we have to have all our patrons off the premises, that means that those staff that may not be required now possibly cannot get back on the pub payment. That's an issue that's going to face, especially the nighttime economy sector, for those staff that are coming back for the first time. So we're in a phase now that we need to get this right. We need to make sure we protect the health nation first of all, but we also need to engage with businesses around how they operationalise their business over the next number of weeks ahead.
And is Monday and Tuesday enough time for you to work all that out?
Well, we've been here before and we've always said that the government should have a direct line of access and communication to the hospitality industry. And they did so at the last time we were in this position where we were looking at a reopening phase, and it didn't go ahead in the way that we thought it was. So we would like the government now to open up communication with us today so that we know exactly what's going to happen over the next number of days.
Adrian Cummins, CEO of the Restaurant Association, thank you for speaking to us.
Now, we all know at this stage that global supply lines have been hit hard by the COVID pandemic. The latest in the US, the port of San Francisco is so blocked with containers that haven't been delivered containing goods from Asia, the goods that would have been holiday purchases this winter, that President Biden has asked Walmart, UPS and FedEx to work flat out 24/7 to help ease the supply chain bottlenecks. As I say, it's a global problem. And there may be no simple or quick solution. Let's talk to lecturer Damien O'Reilly from TU Dublin once more about this. And this latest initiative for Joe Biden, he had this big summit, he called in the heads of the companies, the port of San Francisco, the main landing point for goods coming in from Asia, goods that were destined for supermarket shelves in the holiday season. What's your take on what's going on around the world, Damien?
Well, it certainly is a crisis, a global crisis. And what's happened is, you know, COVID last year when it hit China first, is then China closed down. So production stopped over there. And then the knock-on effect that had in Western Europe and in the United States meant that there were containers which never got back to China. Excuse me. Also, production couldn't be ramped up. What actually happened is that we were at home, so we were spending more money on products rather than on services, so we couldn't go out to eat or drink or whatever. Is that we spent more money on products, so we went a lot online, bought a lot of stuff online, which meant that a lot of stuff then couldn't be ramped up because China was at full capacity. With that as well, you know, COVID and in China has meant that the third largest port in China was closed for 3 weeks there. Also in Vietnam, a big producer of goods for the West, they've been closed. A lot of their ports have been closed because of COVID as well. So, you know, the house as well has become more important. So all of these kind of products that we look for, the house, a house and home, have been affected. IKEA have said they're going to be affected. Smiths have said they're going to be affected. Primark said they're going to be affected as well. So there are going to be shortages coming up to Christmas. So I'd advise anyone who's buying is to buy sooner rather than later if they see the product available. It doesn't mean we'll have bare shelves, but what it means is that some of the more popular items may not be available. And another company that is talking about having issues is Lego, for example.
Oh my goodness, that really would be. Yes, yeah. Let's not even think about that. And this is all coincided. Go on, Damien.
Sorry, yeah. The bigger containers are coming in. You know, the ones that are being turned back from Felix, though, you know, some of those are due to end up in Ireland. And what's happening is those containers contain 24,000, up to 24,000 containers on them. So, you know, to get that into a port, to lift those off is probably taking around 3,000 people to work 24 hours a day for 3 days to get one tanker unloaded. And now they're being redirected, which is going to take extra time and puts extra time into the time to get to the shelves.
And this is all time.
There's no quick way around it.
Yeah, and this is all coinciding, isn't it? There are shortages in things like semiconductors. We've got worldwide at the moment, you know, shortages of gas, and we've got shortages of labour, you know, the truck drivers and the delivery people and the port workers. So is this a temporary phenomenon or something that's likely to be with us for more into the medium term?
Well, it's certainly going to last until probably mid-2022, you know, because these ships and tankers, they take a long time, you know, 6 weeks to get from Asia to Europe. So you can't just speed this up very, very quickly. And as he said, there, the component part, the likes of Apple are using a component coming from China, and it hasn't come from China, besides the semiconductors, which has meant that the iPhone, for example, the new iPhone, they can't produce as many as they'd like to because of a lack of components. Mm-hmm. Now, the components are available, but they can't ship them over quick enough. Other companies, the likes of Walmart, for example, as you mentioned in your introduction there, Walmart, for example, are... they've hired or leased smaller ships so to get into smaller ports rather than the big ports. So that's what they've done to get around it. IKEA are using trains from China into Europe to bring product into it. The likes of Boohoo and ASOS are using air freight to bring stuff in that they didn't use before. So all of these are ways that retailers are looking to get around whatever this is going to be an issue in the small or the medium term.
It's fascinating stuff. Thanks indeed for enlightening us all on it. Damien O'Reilly from TU Dublin there.